come from the bowels of hell.
The Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats run around your feet.
I bought a dog that killed the calf that ate the canary. What is truth?
And once again, welcome back.
There have been so far only two positives from this pandemic that I can see. One, Zoom technology has finally led us to the long-delayed question, wait a minute, so all this time I could have been doing your goddamn podcast from my house? Turns out, yes. And I don't see that going back to how we used to do it in the before times after this pandemic has gone away. We'll see. The second cool thing has been the release of Alphabet Land by the band X. John Doe, Exene Cervenka, Billy Zoom, and DJ Bonebreak formed X in the heyday of the late 70s LA punk scene. Their first album, Los Angeles, was released in 1980, and they quickly made an indelible mark on American music. I love X. I always have. And I had heard, being a fan, that they were recording some stuff, and I naturally assumed it was like a one-off for a soundtrack or another anthology or something. Then, last month, on the 40th anniversary of the release of Los Angeles, Bandcamp announced that the album Alphabet Land, X's first new studio album in almost 30 years, was available for immediate download. The what? So I immediately bought it, sat down to listen, and I knew it would be good. They're good. But it's their first album in 27 years. I was prepared to grade on a curve. No need. It blew my socks off. From the first cut to the last, it is a 27-minute punk rock fist to the solar plexus, starts out great, never lets up, ends with a flourish. Now, many of you may recall that last year, Mr. Doe and our mutual friend, Tom DeSavia, were kind enough to invite me to moderate the panel for their book, More Fun in the New World, which was the second installment of their two-part oral history of LA punk, the first being Under the Big Black Sun, both available where fine books are sold. So I put out the word to Tom and our other mutual friend, Danny Bland, and publicists were contacted, phone calls were made. I was apparently and fortunately deemed not too creepy. And I am proud and happy to say that John Doe and DJ Bonebreak are on the podcast today to talk about the album. In the words of John Doe from the X documentary, The Unheard Music, let us get on to our filthy business.
It.
We are joined today by the percussionist of X and the percussionist / xylophone player of the Flesh Eaters, lovely and talented DJ Bonebreak.
This is my voice. Hello. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much. And I guess the founder of the band and bassist, vocalist, one of the co-songwriter, the author of More Fun in the New World and Under the Big Black Sun, please welcome John Doe.
Hello, Dana. This is my voice, John Doe. Are we really one of your favorite bands, or are we just your favorite band?
I would say I'll be honest with you. In my mental rock and roll heaven, I have you, the Pixies, and Elvis Costello and the Attractions all in a bull ring with chainsaws and hammers. And whoever comes out, comes out.
I get the mace. I want the mace and I want the net, the net to snare your feet.
but not to blow too much smoke up your backsides. But, and I've talked about it at length on the podcast. So the people who are listening are probably sick of hearing me say this, but Axl is one of those bands that you get, you find them in your youth and in your teens and your twenties, and they help you define who you are.
Mm.
And that goes away around 27 if you are hopefully living your life properly. but it was one of those moments where I go, oh yeah, this is my group. This is where I'm over here. This is mm-hmm. who I belong with.
Well, the same thing happened to me too. I had amnesia at 27, but luckily I'm coming out of it.
I'm curious what goes away? What part of it goes away?
I think that hopefully by the time you're in your late 20s and early 30s, that you have a sense of who you are and you're not so covertly influenced by externals. Like,
got it.
You know,
yeah.
You know, yes, in my early 30s, I heard MC Hammer and I did wear those pants.
You're but a brave who didn't? Man. You're a brave man, Dana Gould. I love it.
But the question is, who didn't?
That's right.
Let's just get some geography out of the way because of Zoom technology. And it's just a fun fact to know that many of the people in our federal government who were warned that the pandemic was coming and then didn't tell the public but did divest themselves and invest in remote meeting technology.
Yes.
We're now helping put money in their pocket.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing.
I would like to give you the flip side of these remote conference calls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, every motherfucker who wants a piece of me or us says, oh, why don't you just record a couple of songs and we'll just put it up on our website? And I can't say, no, I'm busy, I'm on tour, because they know that I'm trapped like a rat. In my damn house. And some people, it's like, you don't want to say no because you don't have enough followers because you're a little guy. And so you end up, it's like the same dilemma of, oh God, I guess I have to say yes. Oh no.
No, you don't have to, John. I'll tell you what to say.
Okay.
You could say, I'm writing an opera. That takes a lot of time.
Yes.
Or writing a novel.
Okay.
So you're busy. You wake up early. You're tired by 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't. So something like that.
Yeah. Or just like, have you ever heard of butter sculpture? Hello. This takes time. Yeah. My friend, my friend George Meyer, who, he would respond, to questions like that with, because people would always say, like, hey, could you bring some cells of the show and we could sell? And he would always go, wow, that sounds like a great idea for you.
Yeah, you see, comedians can do that.
That sounds like it would work really well for you. But no, I know. And when you're out there slinging that hash, you know, but recording songs, I was like, well, why don't you play? We just recorded it. That's the whole point of having a recording.
Yeah. Well,
they want an exclusive.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't.
Anyway.
Because of this, DJ, you're here in beautiful Southern California.
I certainly am.
And
that's
John,
where you are too.
I am. Mm-hmm. And John, you're in Texas now.
Austin, Texas. Yes, sir.
Austin, Texas, which is. Mm-hmm. Not so much Texas as once described, a beautiful city surrounded by Texas.
Oh yeah, I don't hate Texas. There's some political differences, but you know, big surprise, some of the politicians are freaking idiots. And,
sure,
you know, that's true anywhere. And
yeah.
And yes, I like I'm really becoming enamored with the land. I'm reading a bunch of Texas history, which is all blood and guts, and that's fun.
And you have horses, because I follow you on Instagram.
Yeah, I do. And the Comanches, oh boy, boy, did they teach everybody a lesson. I mean, eventually they went the way of the Indians. What?
I'm sorry, is that a football team?
No. It's a real tribe, as opposed to all this bullshit when people say, well, my tribe. As soon as someone says my tribe, they just go like down about 10 points on my list.
Yeah.
My opinion of them drops by a good 10 or 15 points. My tribe.
On the dough scale.
Yes.
The most common pop cultural touchstone of the Comanches, which bears as much to the reality as you guys do to the punk rock episode of Saved by the Bell, but they were the tribe that kidnapped Natalie Wood and the Searchers. And yes. So many people based on the Searchers would think that the Comanches were old Italian actors in Alice Cooper wigs. This is back when.
The good old days.
You watch these old Westerns and it's like all of these guys, these old Jewish guys and these long black. We're from Nevada. We came all the way over here. Was the band, what was the Indian tribe in F Troop was the Hakawis. Because they could say, we're the Hakawis. F Troop, like Hogan's Heroes, a show you couldn't do today.
Yeah, true.
What's your show? It's a comedy, takes place in a Nazi prison camp.
No, not so much.
Well, Texas, this goes into an interesting thing about the pandemic, and then we'll talk about your album. You know, the symbol of so much of what Texas symbolizes, the theory of rugged individualism, which is such an iconic part of the American identity.
Yeah.
Doesn't work well in a pandemic. Because, you know, you can be a rugged individualist and also know that there are times when the team has to run in the same direction.
Right.
And there's something innate in the American mindset that says, well, if everybody's going over here, I'm going to go over here.
Right.
And that's why I think you have people furious that they can't go bowling. It's not that they can't go bowling. It's that they're being told not to go bowling.
And well, they should make it mandatory, you know,
yes.
Reverse psychology.
Exactly. And then they wouldn't.
Everyone has to go outside all the time, and you know, if you cover your yeah. face, you'll be arrested.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, and to that end, it will be interesting to see. And fortunately, we're young enough that we'll see it. If this, it's clearly the ending of some kind of era. It will be interesting to see if we learn anything from it.
I hope so. However, don't confuse the dumbhead lieutenant governor of Texas, something Patrick.
Right, who said that old people would be happy to die if it kept the economy moving.
Yeah, and that he would be willing to step in there. Don't confuse that dumbhead with the other dumbhead from Georgia who just wanted to open the nail salons,
yeah.
the nail salons and bowling alleys.
Right, and the guy in Georgia said that he didn't know that there were people that were carrying the virus that didn't have symptoms of the virus. So it's funny. He should have checked with the CDC. Where is the CDC?
It's in Georgia.
Oh, it's in Georgia.
Ay, ay, ay.
You can't make it up. The album Alphabet Land came out on the 40th anniversary of the release of your album, Los Angeles. But that was not the initial plan. What was the initial plan, John Doe, for 200?
The initial plan was to do the average thing of just putting out a record in your, you know, set up the trench, build the trench, and then fill it with gold and everybody comes to get their pudding, and everyone is loving the gold pudding.
This went right into the pudding trench analogy that we haven't heard yet in quite a while.
That's right. I frequently use the pudding trench. but then the record company, Fat Possum, said, we don't know when the pressing plants are going to be up and running full speed. We don't know when the printer is going to be fully operational. We don't know so many things. We don't know if the tour that you have planned in August and September is going to actually happen. All these different things. And they said, what if we just put it on Bandcamp for 10 days and you guys get $10 a record and it pays off most of your recording budget, the bill for the recording. And we said, what? You're what? And it took about 5 minutes to go, hell yes, let's do it. Because our fans and people in general could use a little something to brighten their day. And then we had just finished mastering it. And that's also a frustrating thing. Oh, hello, dog. Your dog just walked by.
He's fired.
No, it's really frustrating when you master a record, you're done and you want to share it with everyone. And then you usually have to wait for 4 to 6 months while all the other machine parts get going. And then they
marketing
by that time, doing all these long, long range interviews, or what do they call it? Long lead time interviews and things like that. So we just said, screw it. Let's put it out. Let's go. We'll explode the bomb and then figure out how to, make the trench for the pudding after the bomb goes off.
Right. No, Bandcamp is a fantastic a way to access music and to get music. What's amazing is that you actually do see residuals. Like, oh wait.
Yeah.
They're actually giving me money for this.
Yeah, and you can actually watch it on the screen. My wife said, hey, look at this on the computer. And you can watch it for hours. You can watch the sales go by.
Yeah.
And you wait and you go, there it is.
And what is great, the sort of what's terrific is the punk rock theory of the DIY theory actually has machinery to make it effective. And to make it you actually see your profits and there is a straight line from the artist to the audience that works. But when you say you're going to make an album, it's not that you were just making an album. This was your first album since 1993. Your first album is Los Angeles in 1980, and then you go Wild Gift, Big Under the Big Black Sun, More Fun in the New World, Ain't Love Grand, See How We Are, Live on the Sunset Strip, and that takes you up to 1988. And then you go your separate ways, and then you come back together in 93 for Jesus. Do you feel like Al Pacino in The Godfather 3? Like just when you think you're out, they bring you back in?
See, right after that, we did the anthology record, and Tom DeSavia had a lot to do with that.
Right.
And
which is how I know you, actually.
Okay, yeah, I think I heard that. And so that was an album of, it was an anthology of things we had released and extra tracks. And so it was a double album, I guess. And so when that was released, there was a lot of interest in having us play live again. We'd taken some time off. Correct me if I'm wrong, John. There was interest in hearing the band with Billy Zoom, because Tony Gilkison was in the band as the guitarist, in between.
He played, and Tony Gilkison from Lone Justice came in at the very end of the original arc of the band on See How We Are, I believe.
Yeah. And I guess he joined in 86. So there was, in fact, we did a record signing when the anthology record came out at Tower Records on Sunset, and we were signing for maybe 3 hours, you know, there were the line was going down the block, and there was a lot of interest to hear the band live. So, you know, someone asked, I forget how it happened, but someone asked Billy if he would do it. We got a couple of offers, and we played two shows, one in San Francisco and one here in L.A. at the Palladium. And big surprise, we really enjoyed it. And we said, well, let's play some more. So why we haven't recorded since then, I'll let John answer that, because I'll set him up for that. I think we just forgot. We forgot how to record. That's it.
Billy Zoom, who combines the guitar wizardry of Pete Townsend with the stage movement of John Entwistle. It's really an interesting combination.
That's a good one.
That's a good one. I haven't heard that. Well, did you come up with that?
I just made it up. It's yours.
That's a good one, man. That's a good one. Because you got two guys from the same band, too.
Yeah.
Nice.
With my compliments.
Yes, I appreciate it. Well, Tony Gilkison had, because of some prodding and questioning and so forth, we thought, we're really not as good after doing Jesus and touring on that through 97, I would say, and just doing gigs. Tony was much more of a roots player. And we thought, you know what? We're not as good a roots band as we are a punk rock band. So what do you think, Tony? Do you want to play punk rock or do you want to play roots music? Because we're thinking that we're a better punk rock band than a roots band. And he said, you know what? I'm not interested in playing in a punk rock band. And so 97, 98, something like that. We said, okay, cool. So X is over. We don't want to do this, what we've been doing. So X is over. So there was about a year and a half where we didn't play. And within that year, the anthology came together. And that was an eye-opener for me. Because I listened to probably 200 hours of tapes and live stuff, and along with Tom DeSavia and DJ and everybody. But I finally realized, oh, shit, we were really good. I heard all these live shows that were like terribly recorded, but it was, you could tell that it was just on fire. I thought, huh, okay, well, now I sort of understand what everybody was on about.
Yeah, because you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, you're just
you
playing.
Don't see.
Yeah, you're playing fucking gigs, you know, and
you're looking really out.
Cool. Yeah, you're busy. You're busy doing your thing. Yeah. So 20 years after the fact, you can have some perspective on it. And like DJ said, we did that signing for the anthology, and there was some interest, and through a few different people, I think it was Xene that said, so do you want to play or not? And the Billy said yes. And the moment we got together, it was like riding a bicycle. And it sounded like X. It sounded like us. It didn't take, oh my God, we forgot how to play, because DJ is a great player. Billy's a great player. And we just do this thing. So the reason we didn't record is because we couldn't see a way forward. Like, I can be pretty controlling in the studio. And I think I was really, really judgmental back in the old days, and so is Billy. Billy has really strong opinions about what is music and what isn't. And I have come to really appreciate that, because it keeps you from getting too far outside of the kind of lines. You know, you got to color somewhat within the lines. But my opinion was, well, fuck it. We're artists. We can do anything we want. We're punk rock. We can whatever, you know. But there is something that you got to kind of keep within a certain boundary.
But there is a natural progression. You're a punk rock band, and then because you're also a professional musician and an artist, you want to try like. You want to bring in play a funk song on More Fun and expand your boundaries and paint with different colors. And then you sort of reach out to the point where you feel you've like
you went in the direction of roots music, and the culture at the time was going in that way. There was a huge Lone Justice and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you do the good thing. Okay. I want to go back to the bass. I want to go back. And so there is sort of an ebb and a flow.
Yes.
To, I think, any creative endeavor. You don't want to just do the same album over and over and over and over and over.
No. Although the Ramones did that, and it was
exactly
great.
Where I was going. And oddly, Billy Zoom is wearing a Ramones t-shirt and All of Your New Press, which sort of like he is literally wearing it on his sleeve.
Since we toured so much between, say, 2000 and 2018, as many as 100 dates a year for the 40th anniversary in 2017 to maybe 50 dates, but at least 50 dates a year. So that's enough. Enough to make a nice living, and mm-hmm. also enough to either bury the hatchet, figure out that your brother in arms is actually not your enemy, and let bygones be bygones and not sweat the small stuff and things like that. So, I don't know who introduced Billy to Rob Schnaff, our producer, but they got off. They got along, and they liked the same kind of gear, and they liked the same kind of, And it wasn't just me and DJ and Xene on one side and Billy on another. It was we just couldn't see a way forward. It just didn't mm-hmm. make sense. We didn't have a record company. We didn't have a producer. We didn't have a place. We didn't have any of that stuff. And it sounds kind of mercenary or lame that you know, we have to have a place for the art that we make. But at this point in your life, why are Xene and I going to write a bunch of songs if there's no place to put them? Every once in a while, Xene would give me some lyrics, and I'd work on a song and put it on a solo record. But we weren't going to write them.
I wanted to bring DJ into this part of it too, because you're also DJ. You have side projects. You have this Syncopators.
Syncopators. So syncopators. I did the Bone Break Syncopators. I play with a lot of people, and John was talking earlier about keeping the band within a framework. You know, it's fun to do other things, jazz and funk.
Sure.
And one of the ways you can get that out of your system is to play in other bands. You know, I play jazz. I play country music, and just about everything, anything that pays or anything that's fun.
You are one of the few punk rock xylophone masters.
What I'm playing in the band is a vibraphone. It's the metal version of a xylophone. I play that and I do that for fun. Now I'm doing it. I'm playing it in X for maybe three numbers, I forget how many years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we started doing some acoustic shows for fun and to break it up. You know, I played some vibraphone and mm-hmm. we played softer versions of stuff and played some acoustic. Use some acoustic instruments, and that kind of morphed into the show. We started incorporating some of those arrangements into our regular punk show.
That was what I wanted to ask you. When you're working on something with the Syncopators, in the same way that as John was talking about getting lyrics from Xene and putting them on a John Doe album, are you working on a song of the Syncopators and you're like, god damn it, this feels like an X song. Do I take this over to the band or do I do this here?
No.
And
usually not. With what I'm doing? No, because that's kind of straight ahead, jazz, or not straight ahead. It's actually kind of old school swing, mm-hmm. but country swing. And so I don't write that much. I've written some tunes and I've released them. I had another band called Orchestra Superstring, a Latin jazz band, instrumental band. And I wrote some songs for that. But it's not something I do naturally. But I have to say, on this, when we were writing this album, Xene kept prodding me, kept saying, DJ, you could write a solo vibe piece, for the band to play. And I just couldn't imagine how the band would play that. you know. And then I realized later, after we had almost finished recording, I could have done whatever I wanted, and we would have just incorporated it.
Yeah,
but I didn't have the vision, or you know.
Well, there's whatever. That leads me right back to where I wanted to what I wanted to ask John. Because funny, it's funny I mentioned the Who, and because they were in my mind, because I remember reading some interview with Townsend, you know, when they were doing one of their last regular run albums. I think it was Face Dances. And Townsend just said to the band, "What do you want to sing about? And I'll go write it." And to me, it seems like that seemed very, probably more mercenary than it actually was. But, you know, John, do you, in your writing, is there a difference between an X album and a John Doe album? When you're, you know, like your last album was Westerner?
Yeah.
Do you, are there songs on that could have been on Alphabet Land, or that like there's no way this would have been on Alphabet Land? Do you write in a different head when you're writing for X or when you're writing for yourself?
Yes, a different head. There's probably one or two songs on each one of my solo records that I think could be an X song, but I was encouraged and also gave myself a little bit of a talking to write these songs on bass, because that's what I did for the first four records. Well, the first three records, and then a few songs on the fourth record were written on guitar. And it gives Billy more latitude to figure out if they're major or minor chords, how he wants to voice them. If I come in with a guitar, then he's immediately influenced by the way that I'm playing it. So it's harder for him to come up with his own part.
Right.
On this record, we've given DJ and Billy songwriting credit, because as we worked on these, they added so much more. They were much more open and much more helped define the songs by either some of the rhythms that DJ played, and or what became clear that like those chord changes don't work on the verse part. The chorus is good, but let's try something else for the verse. It doesn't have enough tension, or it just doesn't sound right, or it doesn't feel right, or whatever. So I would, you know, Billy would make a suggestion, or what if we play these chords twice as long? What if we just have a whole different part? So we're all sharing in the songwriting, which is good for unity, but also because of the contribution, everybody was a lot more engaged and, you know, kind of more open about, you know, like I said, I was more judgmental and controlling. So rather than protecting my ego and saying, well, I wrote this song, I know which way it's supposed to go. And which, you know, that works if you want to be an asshole.
But, yeah. There's the comedy version of that as well. I'm very familiar with it. You know,
it's, yeah.
I'm very familiar with it.
But actually, if you just say, oh, well, maybe I don't know what's, but I'll take those words and I'll rework them, and then we'll try some other chords, whatever, fuck it. But I definitely, in solo stuff, I've had more general concepts of what I want the record to sound like. And this, I just knew, I think we all knew that we just wanted to make an X record. And I'm really proud of ourselves for not trying to force in some like slow song or some song that was sort of dirge-like, which I really for a long time wanted to find that song and put it on the record. But now the fact that it's all 27 minutes long, you know, and it's mostly up tempo, and so it's just, it's, you know, what people can use at this point.
And it's just so fucking good. It's better than it has a right to be. It sounds like it's the album you made after See How We Are, but you made it in 1988. Yeah. You know, if you just, I don't hear sonically a step missed.
It's coming. Here it comes. It's intermission time. Time to visit our concession stand.
Barbecue, barbecue, barbecue. Our barbecue is prepared especially for you.
They're true tales from Weirdville. Tales from Weirdville. And they're true.
Can your heart stand the shocking facts?
X called their first album Los Angeles because they wanted to reclaim the city's identity. You have to remember that the heyday of punk, the late 70s and early 80s, coincided perfectly with the heyday of disco. In a way, it makes perfect sense, yin and yang. During that period of time, to most of the country, when they thought of Los Angeles, they thought about the world depicted in the movie Boogie Nights, satin jackets, blow-dried hair, and roller boogie. Roller boogie, you ask? Yes! Roller boogie was a short-lived craze, depicted best in the 1979 film Roller Boogie, that combined disco and roller skating. Because someone had the great idea, you know what would go great with being gacked out on cocaine? Having wheels on my feet! Here's a fun fact. The movie Roller Boogie was shot by the same cinematographer who shot John Carpenter's The Thing, a guy named Dean Cundey. But that's understandable, as they're both horror movies, albeit in different ways. But I do like the fact that as disco rose to prominence, punk rock was born. To quote Ken Watanabe in Godzilla, "Nature finds a balance. Let them fight." All the more fitting that this particular battle was set in Los Angeles, which is a living, breathing, cultural dichotomy on display for all to see. For LA is the land of both Angeline and Elizabeth Short. And sadly, you can't have one without the other. And no one did more to bring the soft, dark underbelly of the City of Angels out into the light more than Raymond Chandler. Like all things identified with Los Angeles, be it palm trees or the film industry, Raymond Chandler came from somewhere else. Chandler was born in Chicago in 1888. His father was a brutal alcoholic. Keep an eye peeled for this theme. Chandler's father abandoned their family, and his mother moved him to London, she was originally from Ireland, to give him the best shot at a quality education. While in Europe, Chandler's mother supported her son and herself with the help from a wealthy uncle who was, by all accounts, a total dick about it. Raymond Chandler originally worked in the British civil service but disliked its incessant formality and tried his hand at reporting and writing poetry on the side, going for that sweet poetry green. While he was trying to make a go of it as a writer, Chandler met British poet Richard Barham Middleton. Now, Chandler wisely considered Middleton a far better writer than he was at that time. But despite that, soon after their meeting, Middleton committed suicide, a suicide of despair, as Chandler called it. And this served to, let's say, dampen Chandler's hopes for success in his desired vocation. Then it was a ping-pong period for Raymond Chandler. By his own admission, he was not a happy-go-lucky, satisfied fellow. Imagine the Smiths song, "Is It Really So Strange," playing beneath the following section.
I left the north again, I traveled south again.
As this period of Chandler's life reads like an early 20th century version of a Morrissey travelogue. He moved from London to San Francisco, where he studied bookkeeping. Then he moved to Los Angeles, where he picked fruit and strung tennis rackets. Then he moved to Vancouver and joined the Royal Canadian Expeditionary Force. They sent him to France, where he fought in the trenches in World War I. See Peter Jackson's documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old.
to see how fun that was. He caught the Spanish flu twice in the 1918 pandemic we discussed two episodes of this podcast back, and was training to be a pilot in the Royal Air Force when the war ended. He seemed to hold a number of citizenships. It was then back to Canada and finally a return to Los Angeles, where by now his mother had relocated. Chandler got a job with the Dabney Oil Syndicate and took up a relationship with Pearl Eugenie Pascal, who was 18 years his senior. His mother did not approve of the relationship, so Chandler had to wait until she died to get married, which she did. And then he did. This was in 1924. The next 7 years saw Raymond Chandler, a married man with a steady, decent, reliable job with an oil company. By 1931, he had worked his way up from bookkeeper to vice president.
But he can't help the way he feels.
And apparently, he felt very badly about it. According to the Chandler biography, The Night of Sunset Boulevard by Pico Iyer, or Iyer, Chandler was fired in 1931 for his alcoholism, absenteeism, promiscuity with female employees, and threatened suicides. By now, it was the Great Depression, which was a bad time to be without income, and so Chandler returned to writing. This time, he made a beeline for what was selling, and that was pulp detective fiction. In 1950, he wrote the following in a letter to his British publisher. "Wandering up and down the Pacific coast in an automobile, I began to read pulp magazines, because they were cheap enough to throw away. It struck me that some of the writing was pretty forceful and honest, and even though it had its crude aspect, I decided that this might be a good way to try to learn to write fiction and get paid a small amount of money at the same time. I spent 5 months over an 18,000-word novelette, and I sold it for $180. After that, I never looked back, although I had a good many uneasy periods looking forward. Newsstands were full of magazines, like Black Mask and True Detective, that were, as Chandler said, cheap enough to throw away. They were tales of crusading police detectives fighting in the shadows for truth and justice. Now, these magazines were called pulps, because unlike high-end glossy magazines, they were printed on cheap wood pulp paper, hence the term pulp fiction. Chandler taught himself how to write pulp fiction by breaking down and studying a novelette by Stanley Earle Gardner, who created the character of Perry Mason. The fictional lawyer made TV famous decades later by Raymond Burr, known in Hollywood as the Iron Duchess. Look it up. Anyway, back to Raymond Chandler. He wrote a story called Blackmailers Don't Shoot that was published in Black Mask in 1933. He then wrote his first novel called The Big Sleep. Yep, The Big Sleep was his first novel. It is a complicated story told through the eyes of a private detective named Philip Marlowe. Marlowe is called to the home of General Sternwood. It's nice when your real name is also your porn name. General Sternwood is the head of a very wealthy and very powerful Los Angeles family. And they are as dirty and corrupt as they are wealthy. And Marlowe's no prize. Hard drinking, wisecracking, no family to speak of. Philip Marlowe became a modern-day Charon, guiding readers across the river Styx of glitz into the fiery hell of LA's underworld. Chandler followed The Big Sleep with Farewell, My Lovely, which was also told through the eyes of Philip Marlowe. Farewell, My Lovely was made into a film, which, though the screenplay was written by a different writer, to paraphrase Jerry Geisler and Barton Fink, Hollywood had taken an interest. Billy Wilder called and suggested that they adapt James N. Cain's tawdry novel Double Indemnity for the big screen, which they did, while Chandler was sober, which was during an increasingly small window of time. Chandler was a tortured fellow. Although he did love his wife Eugenie, known to the world as Sissy, it didn't stop him from loving other women as well. Among them, his literary agent, his secretary, George Orwell's widow, and his friend Steven Spender's wife. Now ping-ponging back and forth between written fiction and Hollywood screenplays, Chandler had the money to indulge his desires for unrequited love and very requited drunken stupors. But as long as he was making people money, he was indulged and indulged and indulged. It's an old story. His only original screenplay was called The Blue Dahlia. Not The Black Dahlia, The Blue Dahlia, and we'll get to that. The film was produced by John Houseman of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater fame. The only problem is that as the film went into production, Chandler hadn't written the ending yet. And according to John Houseman, Chandler said he could only write it when drunk. If Houseman could provide him with a secretary and a driver, around the clock, mind you, he could then get shit-faced enough to get the damn thing finished.
Hooray for Hollywood!
He finished it and received his second Academy Award nomination for screenplay, Double Indemnity being the first. Chandler was then hired by Alfred Hitchcock to adapt Patricia Highsmith's novel Strangers on a Train. Chandler thought the story was a little too implausible for his own liking, and he clashed with Hitchcock repeatedly. Supposedly, Hitchcock overheard him referring to him as that fat bastard, and the two stopped talking. Raymond and Sissy Chandler then moved out of Hollywood down to La Jolla, a suburb of San Diego, in 1946. It was there that Chandler wrote the Marlowe novels The Long Goodbye and Playback. Although he had moved to Orange County, Marlowe continued to define and give voice to the darker L.A. that cool people love and cherish. If you want to refresh your Philip Marlowe knowledge, you can't beat The Big Sleep, Farewell My Lovely, and The Long Goodbye. Here are some tips. When you're reading the books, Bay City is Santa Monica, California. Gray Lake is Silver Lake. And Idle Valley is the wealthier neighborhoods of the San Fernando Valley. But it's all Los Angeles. So much so that Chandler's fictitious Los Angeles began to seep into the real one. On the morning of January 15th, 1947, a young woman was walking her baby by a vacant lot at the intersection of 39th and Norton in what is now known as South Central Los Angeles. She saw what she believed to be a discarded dress mannequin tossed into the weeds. Upon further investigation, the dress mannequin turned out to be the body of a woman named Elizabeth Short. The brutality of Miss Short's murder was so off the charts that local newspapers, who were fond of coining nicknames and slang for criminals in their cases, dubbed it the Werewolf Murder. Once details of Short's life came into focus, she had black hair, she had a penchant for black clothes, she adorned her hair with dahlia flowers. Los Angeles crime reporters coined the name the Black Dahlia, basing it on Raymond Chandler's The Blue Dahlia, which had just been in theaters. The crime would go on to become the most famous unsolved murder case in Los Angeles history. A woman from Massachusetts, found dead beneath a palm tree trucked in from Florida, named after a work of fiction written by a guy from Chicago. What could be more LA than that? Before we get back to the interview, I would like to say one word to you about our Patreon feature. Patreon is what allows me to keep making the show. Period. It is a full cooperative effort between myself and the names that you hear at the end of this show, and Patreon is what allows me to pay those people for their time and their hard work. And that's the truth, Ruth. Our Patreon, it's $5 a month, and it gets you the title Dana Gould Hour Sky Cadet. And for that, you get extra video content, etc. For this episode, I will be posting some of the video excerpts from my Zoom call with John and DJ. In recent months, I've posted some of the pilots I've made that have not aired that we discussed on the show, some video of stand-up shows that I filmed for my records only, but now they're up for you. Coming up soon, we will be posting, just for Patreon, the full library of all the past True Tales from Weirdsville middle pieces, going all the way back to episode 1. Just the middle pieces, indexed and placed there for your browsing convenience. We also have this month a free gift, with strings attached. A public service announcement poster by graphic artist Jolion Yates from your friend and mine, Dr. Zayas, reminding you all to wash your filthy paws. But we would ask you, if you download this poster, the link is free, take $10 to $20 and send them to your local food bank. We didn't want to be the arbiter of who gets help. We figured, think globally, act locally. So go on over to danagould.com, click on our Patreon page, and dig the riches.
And now, on with the show.
Kat and I were, one of the things that we would do is to get out of the house, sometimes late at night, now late, you know, like 8 o'clock, we'll just drive around town, like, you know, drive down Sunset. 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night, Hollywood Boulevard, we went end to end in about 6 minutes. Nothing there. And we were listening to Alphabet Land and we played it through and got to the end. And then we kind of looked at each other and like, want to just play it again? Can we? And we just played it back. And it's actually a beautiful soundtrack for driving around a deserted apocalyptic Los Angeles.
That was our plan, Dana.
It's all worked out. It's really alarming.
It was made to drive two blocks in West LA, 27 minutes.
Yeah, I know.
Originally.
It's alarming.
Here's an interesting thing. If you make a piece of art and some outside, some things beyond your control happen, it influences your perception of the art. Whether the art was made in response to it or it just happened to happen, it happened at the same time. So you get your heart broken and you listen to the radio and every love song is like, oh man, that's about me. I feel it. And since we've been writing songs about the end of the world and or the world on the edge and having these, cinematic kind of images in a lot of our songs, but there's a lot of coincidence, which I can't claim as prophecy, but you know, things that have been on our minds, like water and wine, you know, the whole disparity of riches, you know, who gets water, who gets wine,
right?
Who gets passed to the head of the line, who has to go to the end of the line, you know, which has been on people's minds. And then Goodbye Year was one of the last songs that I brought in and that we worked on together.
Yeah. Goodbye Year and Strangeland sound like, really? Yeah. You made this before the pandemic? Are you sure?
Yeah. But it's a similar feeling of the end of a year. You just get this weird nostalgic, like, wow, what actually happened that year? And, but without a doubt, the last track, All the Time in the World.
Right.
Exene sort of read that just for the hell of it. She said, hey, you know, I've got this piece. Why don't I just read it? And we had to do a little bit of arm twisting to get her to agree to put it on the record. I played bass and it sounded bad. And then Billy played piano and it sounded great. And then Robbie Krieger came in and did his swells and
all. Is that
crazy stuff, and we did some effects on it and stuff, but it was all him and Rob Schnaff kind of putting it together. But
see, I didn't know that Robbie Krieger played on that.
Yeah,
but it was going to lead to my question that, you know, you are sort of the spiritual inheritors of the Doors. I feel like you carry on the torch of what they, if not started, brought to the forefront. They did it with Horse Latitudes and mm-hmm. some other stuff. And I love that kind of thing. Actually, Townsend had all half an album side that was just spoken poetry over music. All the Best Cowboys Have Chinese Eyes has a lot of that. And I love it. And I didn't know that it was Krieger, but it evoked the Doors to me. As well as Strangeland, which is almost like a semi-sequel to Strange Days. And the middle eight of Strangeland made me feel like Hello, I Love You a little bit. There's a good rhyming, boom, 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 that that played really, and it really felt like you connected to a flow, connected to a thing that exists that continues.
Yeah.
And in terms of what we want to write about, there's a line, there's two lines in All the Time in the World that I'm going to just read for the listeners of the podcast. She says, we have all the time in the world until the limitless possibilities of youthful infinity turn into mortality. And
yeah, man.
Yeah.
Right on, sister.
Not fucking around. But that's a line that you can't write when you're 21. You know, right. Death is this romantic, distant shore when you're 21, if you have that proclivity. And now it's just something that you keep checking the mailbox for. Now it's going to show up like a bill in a red envelope. they really want me to pay this one. And that's the beauty of this album and the heartbreak of The Doors is that they never got to write those songs. We never got to hear that voice with the wisdom of age and time behind it. And that's the beautiful stuff. That's what's so beautiful about Alphabet Land, but still sonically, it sounds like you're 24. The lyrics are, allow you to look back on things with that perspective that, not everybody gets. Oh. And was that something that you realized along the way, or was that something that was part of the plan? Because you said when Los Angeles came out, you said, John, we called the record Los Angeles to put a stake in the ground. And by that you meant?
Here we are, punk rock listeners. Los Angeles isn't all Farrah Fawcett. Fleetwood Mac, swimming pools, and Mercedes Benz. It also is Raymond Chandler, Charles Bukowski, and film noir, the dark underbelly.
Right.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's fitting that Alphabet Land came out on the 40th anniversary of Los Angeles, because this album also puts a stake in the ground. You know, that you are not an oldies act. This is not a nostalgia show. You know, this stuff is organic and throbbing and current. And, it was just, it's bizarre to me that that wasn't the plan, because it really feels like,
well, like I say, I think that external events have, added something to the gravity of it. And I also give DJ Billy and Rob Schnaff a lot of credit for keeping it simple. If it was my production, I probably would have added more little things here and there, little pieces, little counter melodies, and things like that. And right up till the very end, I was saying, oh God, there should be something else on these choruses, and there should be this, and there should be that. And I was kind of outvoted, but that's okay, because in retrospect, it is, lean and mean, and it, like you've been saying, so complimentary, thank you again, that, that's just kind of bullshit, traditional production. Oh, well, you got to have a tambourine on the chorus. Like, no, you don't.
I need just more cowbell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Apropos, we're at 46, so we can, we'll start to land the plane and get you out of here. It's been great. It's
a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here in my house.
What's for dinner?
How are you keeping your sanity with younger children?
To me, having nothing to do would lead to insanity. I am so packed time-wise. That
that's great.
The busyness keeps me sane.
Excellent.
Yeah. Otherwise, I would. You know, it's I believe it's Dharma Bums where Jack Kerouac was like, I'm going to be a fire watcher out in the woods and I'm just going to commute. And he ends up like running, screaming naked through the woods. That's me completely. Like, get me the fuck out of here. That's absolutely me. No, I have to stay busy or I go bananas. What are you doing? My phone dinged two nights ago or three nights ago, and I had a note in my calendar. I was supposed to see X at the Wiltern. I had tickets and everything. And it's sort of like Earth, you know, oh, this is what's going on Earth Prime tonight. there's an X concert at the Wiltern. I'm here in the Phantom Zone. I can't see shit. What are you doing down in Austin to stay sane? Are you just you're doing a lot of press, I'm assuming, for the album?
Going to fucking bowling alleys and nail salons, dummy.
Well, please do it in that order, because there's nothing that will ruin a good nail job than sticking your fingers in the filthy holes of a... By the way, can you imagine a more germ-soaked experience than a... Look, I know that we're being... But I just want to stick my fingers in a dark hole that other people... And wear somebody else's shoes. I just want to do those things. You know, it's like, and then I just want to go to a gym and drink the hot tub water. But by and large, I don't want to go.
Yeah. What am I doing? I am writing some songs here and there. I reworked a song that Garbage and Xene and I did called Destroying Angels. I wrote a song with Grantley Phillips. He sent me a song. There was a video, very traditional kind of country song. And it was all about, you know, staying at home. And he said, here, why don't you record a verse and a chorus? And then we'll send it to Sam Phillips. And so it's Phillips Doe Phillips. And then she sent it back to Grant and he edited them together. And, you know, it was really fun. It was called Stay Safe. And it's on YouTube and stuff like that.
Oh, great.
And then it's essential for me to go visit my animals,
right,
horses at a barn. It's about 20 minutes away from me, and that keeps me sane because it's outside and that's a good thing.
Right. That's and you own several horses.
Just two.
Two.
Not several. Well, just two is more than one. And they're just, you know, I feel a little...
Yeah, and they're not like fish. You got to like check on them on a very regular basis.
Yeah. Well, there is someone who feeds them, and I feel a little bit bourgeois about that. But at the same time, I don't want to, you know, endanger my partner by having them on... I can't afford property like that. So anyway, and you know, but honestly... I miss the hell out of my kids who live in Northern California.
Yeah.
You know, Zoom is all well and good, but it doesn't really do it. And I miss, like, you know, hey, what do you want to do?
Oh,
what do you want to do tonight? You know, and like, let's put on some fun clothes and go out and see our pals. And
DJ, are you parented up or?
Yes. In fact, we're actually, my wife and I are empty nesters. My daughter just moved out at the end of February before all of this happened. She's an English school teacher.
Oh, great!
So she's off on her own. So we're just hanging around the house. You know, it's weird. I had most of January and February off. Besides, we had a X session. We did recorded the second part of the album. But I've been just gearing up to go on tour. So I'm doing the same thing now. I was spending 2 or 3 months practicing drums, which I love to do. I get into a routine.
Sure.
And suddenly I'm doing it for 18 months. I think I don't know what I'm going to sound like. You know,
yeah,
at that time, or I'll just give up. I'm not sure, but I'm just doing the same thing, just staying at home, practicing, watching TV and reading and taking a walk early in the morning before people molest us on the street.
Sure.
Walking around without masks.
Yeah. That's a piss off for sure.
Yeah. I had to stop in a 7-Eleven to get something. And I'm in the parking lot. I put on a mask and well, it's now normal for me to put on a mask before walking into a convenience store.
Yeah. Used to be you just did it for fun and yeah, some excitement.
If I was going to rob them, it would take me like 10 minutes to explain. Like, no, actually, I am here to rob you. I know, this is insane. He'd put on like an N95 and then a ski mask over it. And no, see, yeah. I'm being responsible, but I'm also robbing you. I dread the empty nesting. I have 11, 16, and 17, but my 17-year-old's a junior in high school, and they're all girls, and when they go, it's going to be I have friends that go through it. It's bizarre.
Yeah, you really miss them. I mean, part of it, you like the extra room, you know, and because kids stay too long in their houses these days. It's so hard to move out, especially in LA. Yeah. They can't afford it. But so you really miss having them around and interacting with them. But, you know, but part of it, it's a mixed bag. You know, you like the space and, you know, I set up a stereo right behind me. This was my daughter's room.
Oh,
you
know, okay.
That's I started
funny.
Playing loud music.
Do you have a tentative schedule to pick up the tour? Or is everything dumped out jigsaw
hopeful,
puzzle right now?
No, we're hopeful that we have a tour planned at the end of August, the beginning of September. For about 2-3 weeks, and I'm somewhat hopeful that that might happen.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to happen, but we'll see.
Yeah. I feel pessimistic about it. I mean, I hope we're ready to do that, but yeah. My vote. I mean, I'd love to go. I mean, I'd love to tour more than anyone. You know, and I prepare for it, and you know, I just love it. But I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I can say this with all of the knowledge that the average stand-up comedian has about pandemic science.
That's more than our president.
More than drummers.
Yeah, exactly.
You have more wisdom than a drummer. Okay.
This is the punishment for saying, let the clown drive the bus. It'll be fun. See? Give that chimp that flamethrower. Let's see what happens. Life will resume in fits and starts in different masked versions for the next 2 years before there is a vaccine that is accessible to everyone that allows us to return to some semblance of normalcy. But, you know, COVID-20 is also lurking out there, too. So,
So remember Spinal Tap, where they had the pods?
And yes,
they played in the pods.
That might be you.
Yeah. I think that's the future of rock and roll.
Yeah, or just like everybody in hazmat suits. Like everybody looks like the first version. Yeah, everybody looks like the first version of Devo. Snapshot of a story, 1978. I'm watching the original Saturday Night Live with my brothers. Devo is on in the yellow jumpsuits. My dad comes home from work. He's a bartender. He walks through the living room, looks at what we're watching on television, and without breaking stride says, "What's this? The goddamned asshole show?" which is what I called it when I would go there a lot. So the album is called Alphabet Land. For now, you purchase it on bandcamp.com. Go and do it now. And you have a current
push that you're doing for colored vinyl at record stores. Talk about that for 30 seconds.
They offered red, yellow, and green from the record company you could pre-order. And those sold out in like 15 minutes for the red and yellow, and green took 30 minutes for 500 each of those for the collectors. And then they made blue for indie record stores. So you can order them. I don't know how many they made of those, but they ordered them. You can order them through your independent record company, record store.
And so follow X the Band on Instagram.
Or yes,
for all of this information, or is it X the Band Official?
X the Band Official, okay. Or The John Doe on Instagram
with two E's.
Two E's,
not in Doe.
Yes, X the Band on Facebook, or our website, stuff right. like that.
And we'll have all the links on the podcast page too.
And all your art collectors, Wayne White did the cover, which is he's an awesome artist, and just did unbelievably beautiful job on the cover art.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, and it's perfect because he described it as the curdling American dream, which is like, because I listen to More Fun and I think, oh, we thought this was ending in 84.
Yeah.
Nope.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I was talking about the themes that we've written about and the style of the music. And, you know, Los Angeles has The World's a Mess, It's in My Kiss. More Fun in the New World has I Must Not Think Bad Thoughts in the New World. You know, it's the through thread, you know, lyrically and musically.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, again, like the Doors Before You, it's the James Elroy, Raymond Chandler, LA,
exactly.
Continues on. It's the reason I love living here. Well, anyway, I really appreciate you guys giving me your time, today. I know that you have a lot of stuff. Bowling alleys, nail salons, massage stations. John Doe and DJ Bonebreak from the band X the Band Official on Instagram, bandcamp.com. Buy their album, Alphabet Land. And thank you again. This is so great and a real, you know, treat for me being a fan. I promised DeSavio that I wouldn't fanboy out too much, so hopefully I kept my part of the bargain.
No, you did. You did. What a pleasure. Yeah, well, it was good fun.
Good fun.
Thank you so much, Dana. Appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbauer.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Goldbauer. Brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a person. I'm a singer. I'm a singer, I love to sing, and DJ, boom, peace out, you want me, peace out, boom.